Recording is now started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms, RPMs, and all GTLDs PDP working group call held on the 5th of April, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call, as we have quite a few participants. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. Other than Brian and Steve, if you're only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Kathy Kleinman. Please begin.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Terry. This is Kathy Kleinman, and I'm one of the co-chairs of the working group, as you know, and I see that my other two chairs, Phil Corwin and J. Scott Evans, have joined us on the call as well. I'll be chairing this interesting meeting today. It has two major parts. We'll be talking about the scoping documents for our three subgroups, and then in half an hour at 1:30, we'll be joined by two members of the analysis group, Greg Raffert and Stacy Chan. Greg is the vice president of the analysis group. Stacy is the manager of it. And they'll be presenting their revised report to us on their independent review of the Trademark Clearinghouse Services. So that should be a good discussion as well. But first, I wanted to check and see if there are any updates to Statement of Interest. And hearing none, I wanted to mention another intro note that we had an extensive co-chairs meeting with staff yesterday, and we have put in a request for a face-to-face meeting in Johannesburg. We've requested 3 hours. We've been told we might not be able to get a block that long, that we might get to 1.5-hour blocks, but we wanted to let you know for planning purposes that during that 4-day meeting, we have requested extensive meeting time. And we hope you will be able to join us there, either in person or remotely. Mary, if there's nothing else that we should be covering as preliminary, could you go ahead and post the proposed scope of work for the subgroups? As you know, we put out a call for three subteams, three subgroups, to help us put together the questions for the sunrise period, the trademark claims, and also for private protection subgroup. So right now we're going to talk about the proposed scopes of work. Somebody is making a lot of noise. If it's possible to mute that line, I'd appreciate it. Okay, so right now we're going to talk about the proposed scope of work for two out of the three subteams. The reason why is that we're still, the co-chairs and staff are still working on the proposed scope of work for the private protection subgroup, but we should have that ready shortly. Let me actually put out a call for additional participants right now in this group. We have a number of participants for the trademark claim subgroup. And Mary, maybe you can give us a current status on the number, you don't have to post it, but the number of people in the Sunrise subgroup and the private protection subgroup. Because as of yesterday, we were in active need of more members. And I was wondering if anything has changed since then. Thanks, Mary.
Hi, everybody. This is Mary from staff. Irma may have some updated numbers, but Kathy, basically, they're not that changed from what you, Phil, and J. Scott saw yesterday. Essentially, if we don't count the three co-chairs who are ex officio in all three subteams, I believe we have about 7 members for the trademark claim subteam. So from the staff perspective, that's probably as large a number as will be easy to work with for scheduling and such. For the other two teams, Sunrise and Private Protections, I believe we have no more than 3 or 4 for each. So those would be the two teams that if anyone is desirous of volunteering, those are the two teams that could do with more numbers.
Terrific. This
is Steve Levy. I'll volunteer for Private Protection.
Thank you, Steve. And feel free to put, Christine, you volunteered, if you want to put what group you want to volunteer in the chat room. We'll be happy to do it. Also, feel free to send emails to the list as well. We're asking that everyone volunteer for one. because, again, the trademark claims is full. I'm responding to Christine in the chat room. So if you could pick the subgroup that you'd like to join, that would be great.
Kathy, this is Brian Beckham. Could you refresh my memory what that private protection working group was?
Sure. This is the one that will be looking at questions. And, in fact, let me bounce over to my list. There are questions about private uses of the Trademark Clearinghouse database. And I can't say that we fully define the scope, but we've certainly, in a memo the co-chair sent out, which we can resend out, there were questions raised that there were issues about the private use of the Trademark Clearinghouse in private protected marks lists and other types of things that merit further investigation. So in our current charter questions, the TMCH kind of big picture charter questions that we've been working on, we have a question number 3 in the education category, category 1, that asks what information on the following aspects of the TMCH are available and how can it be found. And it's really about trademark, private trademark services, contractual relationships between the trademark providers and private parties. Sorry, here I'm reading directly. And with whom does the TMCH share data and for what purposes? And this didn't really fit with our general discussion in the TMCH charter big picture. It's really one of the applications of the TMCH database, analogous to the use in Sunrise period and trademark claims. So it seemed better to move it into its own category and look at the issue and define it. And that's one of the reasons we're much later in setting out the scope of work for the subgroup, is it's not nearly as well defined. And again, really kind of mostly big picture questions, but we'll certainly be passing question number 3, the one I just read, to the subgroup, as well as the memo that the co-chair sent out, and as well as other questions that people have or that we've gathered along the way. I don't answer your question. We have more questions than answers right now about the proposed scope of that subgroup. I'll pause and see if you want to respond.
Yeah, thank you. So this will be things like the DPML. So got it.
Yes. Terrific. So we'll have that that scope out later. Let me review we're going to review in a little bit of detail and then discuss and see if it makes sense the proposed scope of work and expected deliverables from the subteams. And from the two that we're setting up right now, the Sunrise period and the trademark claims. And this is interesting because the last subgroup, the one that set out the trademark charter questions, really did a yeoman's job. And because of that, everyone else has a really high standard. So, let me thank the last subgroup that worked so hard. And let me set out what's being asked. There was a consolidated list that we can post if you want, but it was distributed, and Mary will distribute it again, that put together, say, the questions for the Sunrise period. We have questions from the working group charter. We have questions from early working group meetings and community discussions. Believe it or not, there are 16 questions for the Sunrise on the Sunrise period. And so for the first purpose of the subgroup is really to look through these 16 questions and specifically identify what questions can be consolidated, what questions, if any, may need some clarification. Some of them are using abbreviations. We don't want to use abbreviations. What questions, if any, should be deleted because they're duplicates of each other or they're duplicates of something we've already discussed and resolved in the working group? And then what gaps, if any, I'm going to skip over one of the bullet points for a second. What gaps, if any, exist that are not being addressed by the existing questions? And if one is identified, what is the question that the subgroup would propose to the working group need to be answered? Now, none of this is set in stone. All of the work of a subgroup gets presented to the working group for review. But it's just more to guide and consolidate. The other thing that we're hoping is that the subgroup will create a map of what a logical flow is. So let's say question 1 and question 9 for Sunrise period are the same question or variations of a theme. They should be consolidated and put together so we can deal with them in a logical order. Then the third thing we're asking subgroups to do is to do a first pass on identifying the data that might be needed to help address the questions fully. Are there existing or identifiable sources from which that data can be requested? So as you're looking through the questions in detail, we're asking the subgroup to say, hey, what comes to mind? You know, you're the advanced team on all of this. What comes to mind questions we might put out to Deloitte or to IBM or to the community so that we can, so that when the working group gets the question and starts looking at it, hopefully or perhaps it will have the data in front of it that it needs. Again, the last subgroup set a very high bar for all of this, and so we're asking that the new subgroups do these three things. And in fact, in our co-chairs meeting yesterday, we even set out some guidance and some dates on this. So in general, each subteam is expected to conduct a minimum of 2 meetings, and these are teleconferences. You'll have full Adobe Connect capabilities. And either staff can run it or you can appoint a chair. Last time staff ran it, but if it's easier, you can appoint a chair from the members of the subgroup. And at the first meeting, look at the refinement of the charter questions, what we were talking about, the consolidation, the clarification, the duplicates. And then in a second meeting, perhaps set a flow for the questions. What order do you recommend they be considered in? And how does this is kind of a new variation. Specifically, and this is the very last paragraph that we're looking at, specifically the subteam should prepare a proposed workflow outline that matches the proposed timelines from the overall work plan. So you have to look at the amount of time that's allocated for the sunrise period or the trademark claims and try to map it. So if it's 3 or 4 weeks, how would you recommend that we look through the flow of the questions so that we can fit it in with the time frame that we have for consideration? So the subgroup becomes really the experts on these questions and the expert guide for the working group. I'm going to pause there. I've talked a lot, with my apologies. Let me open up and see for the experienced subgroup members and for people who have volunteered, does this make sense? Would you like more clarification? And I invite my co-chairs to join me in answering the questions. Thanks. Any input, questions, variation? Modification. Okay, Jay, Scott, and Phil, I'm glad we were so clear on that. Interesting, as we expected that there would be a further discussion. We are still waiting, actually, for the analysis group to join us. And that's still 15 minutes away. They couldn't come earlier. We tried. Okay. Jay Scott, please go ahead.
Can you all hear me?
Yes. A little weak, but yes.
How about now? Is that better?
Much better.
Okay. I just wanted to say, you know, one of the things we hope that you will do, the two sub-teams, when you look at these questions and you're parsing through them and you decide on, you know, what questions require additional information or from the community, that you really make sure to map that into your workflow, right? Because the master workflow that we have, the work plan that I think Mary sent out either late yesterday or early today, you're going to need to look at when we say we'll be finished with these particular topics, map your work by going backwards, and I would suggest that you if you need additional information, you put those questions toward the end of your work, so that you don't consider those until you have that in. And to the larger group, I think Kathy emphasized, but I also want to emphasize for Phil and myself, that they will be coming back to us with all these reports, and everyone in this working group will have an opportunity to review that work and provide their input on that work. We are not in any way trying to silence any voices. We are just trying to make sure that we keep as efficient as possible.
Thank you, Jay Scott. That's a very valuable clarification, and I really appreciate your words. Map your work by going backwards. I think that makes a lot of sense and will help us with what we've been asked by the GNSO Council to stay on task, as well as by Jeff Newman, who is next in the queue. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, thanks. It's Jeff Newman. I'm
Jeff, you're very low. Is it possible for you to come in higher?
Yeah, how about now? Better?
A little bit.
No, still low? Okay.
But we can hear you.
Sorry,
we can hear you.
I'm a little confused. I thought the subgroups were supposed to be working on answering the charter questions, but it seems to me that the subgroups are only working on refining the charter questions. I'm confused, and it may just be me, and if it's just me, I apologize, but
it's a good question. It's a good question. I'll give my my quick answer, and it looks like Jake Scott is in the queue perhaps to answer as well. And I think this is the difference perhaps between subgroups in subsequent procedures working group and subgroups in the rights protection mechanism working group. The model that we're following here is pretty close to what we did in the TMCH charter questions. The 16 questions we've been working on were mapped out by a subgroup that looked very closely at the charter questions, at the community questions, and kind of found that there were a number of duplicates, tried to bind them together and create a flow through them that made sense. But definitely, it was never my understanding that the subgroup would answer the questions. But let me turn this over to Jay Scott for his views. Thanks.
Sorry, I was on mute. I disagree with Kathy. I think that your first task is to refine the questions and bring that back to the group and then get approval that those are the questions that you should be exploring. Then it's my understanding, and I'll look to Phil to see, that then they would explore those questions, gather additional information, provide a recommended answer to those questions that then the larger group would then weigh in on, rather than us having prolonged discussions with 100 to 400 people about what needs to be done. They would make recommendations to the group based on the work that they're doing independently. And then, of course, we would all look at that work as a group and then get consensus from the larger group on the work done by the smaller group. And then once we reach a consensus at the larger group level, that would become part of our report. There will still be discussion, but it will be sort of a more spurred discussion that will be prompted, let's say, by the recommendations of the subteam. That's sort of how I felt it was going to go. I think Kathy may have a different view, and I see Phil has raised his hand, so I will concede the floor to him.
Okay. And yeah, Jay Scott, this is Kathy. I definitely had a different expectation, especially since we're only asking these groups to meet for a minimum of two meetings. Jeff, you were next in the queue. Would you mind if Phil joined first, and then Phil Corwin, and then we'll return to you? Okay, Phil, go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to give a very non-definitive answer. Certainly, the group should be organizing the work, knocking out the irrelevant questions, consolidating the ones who's duplicative, and analyzing areas where we're going to need additional data to answer the questions. I'm not totally opposed to these groups teeing up some of the answers, but these are such important issues. I'm not comfortable with these groups, particularly since they're so small in membership, preparing totally baked answers for final review by the full working group. I think there's – so basically I'm taking the issue under advisement. I thought we were just organizing, and that's why we're giving them a very brief time span. I don't see how within the 2-3 weeks we're giving them to come back to us, they could possibly come back with substantive recommendations on the issues. I guess I'm not taking sides or answering anyone's question because I want to think about it more, but I'm not well disposed toward groups that have 3 to 6 people answering all the questions on these major issues for our full working group, but I do want to be as efficient as possible. So that's all I can say at the moment.
Great. Phil, thank you for your input. We have we have a discussion going on list as well as people in the queue. Marian Ammer, if I could ask that you kind of keep track in the notes of this discussion, because it may well shape what we'll be doing with the subgroups and what the proposed scope of their work is. So if you could keep track, especially of what's going on in the chat room, because I'm likely to miss that. Jeff, go ahead, please, and thanks for your patience. Jeff, it looks like your hand just went down.
No, I meant to. I was on mute and I hit the wrong button. I'm
sorry. Okay, good to hear you.
Yeah, this is Jeff. So I am much more in line with Jay Scott. I think we've spent now a year on refining charter questions and not really getting to the substance. And my deep, deep concern, and I'll say it as one of the co-chairs of the subsequent procedures, PDP, is that, you know, we're already months behind, although there's an amended work plan which tries to compress certain things. I don't see how we can make the amended work plan and get to things like the URS in August, I think is the latest, if we don't start really drilling down in substance. Everyone's got opinions on this. We have to develop a preliminary report. Yes, we have to get data, and so data can be gathered at the same time as opinions and thoughts and views are expressed. And I really think that if we don't start getting to the substance, we never will, and everything else will be incredibly delayed or not even considered as part of the subsequent procedures, which I don't think anyone really wants. So my recommendation is put aside the two-meeting requirement of the scope. I'm not sure where that came from. If you want to spend the first meeting going through the questions, clarifying them, making sure you all understand what questions you're answering, cool. But then start execution. Start going. Start, and then make the groups bigger, whoever wants to participate. But let's get going, guys. It's a year now. So thanks.
Thanks, Jeff, and a voice of experience as co-chair of another group. We have Michael Graham, then Mary, then George. Michael, go ahead, please.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. Yeah, and my apologies for having only lately joined the working group, but I look forward to working with you all on these issues. In listening to the discussion and from my early review of the various documents going back to the charter, I think it sounds like there's sort of a failure of communication in terms of expectation in terms of the schedule. It certainly, I would agree with you and with Phil that two meetings, 2 weeks to answer the questions is far too short, and also very small groups, you know, are probably not sufficient to really address these questions. At the same time, breaking them out into subgroups from my prior experience on other working groups certainly is a way to approach these for there to be some initial review and then bring it to the entire group so that, you know, some of the matters that are being asked in one way that actually in reviewing it with a group of people in discussion, you can see, oh, these questions go together. It can be a single question. Makes sense. It sounds like the direction, and in order to move things along, as Jeff was just saying, might be to go ahead and sort of revise how we're looking at these subgroups to make them something that would come back to the group as a whole with some, if not answers, at least some preliminary approaches to answering these questions. So that, as he was saying, the first meeting could cover the what are the questions, prepare some drafts, explore them, and recommend which ones to be addressed. And then after that, a month, 2 months, whatever, to actually then deal with those questions and then come back to the group as a whole. That's sort of what I'm hearing. I just thought I'd bring a novice voice in with observations. Thank you.
Michael, thank you for your statement, and thank you for joining the working group. Mary, you're next, please.
Thanks, Kathy. No, I think Michael and others have covered some of what staff was going to say, but, you know, if we can just follow up. The main point here is that it really is for the working group to decide how it wants to proceed. And as Jeff has noted, the approach that was developed in other groups to aid efficiency included subgroups or subteams that were going to do a little bit more than just presenting the questions. If this is the route that we go down, then we just really had two points to make. One is that obviously the overall working group would still be the group to report back to. And Jeff will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe in SubPro that that does happen, that check back, that reporting in, the opportunity for the full working group to make suggestions, ask questions, and even disagree, that is built into the process. The second point that staff would like to make here is that regardless of what the decision is as to the exact depth of analysis that each subteam will get into, at a minimum, what could be helpful on top of refining the questions is for the subteams to point to sources where information is already available, say historical documentation, and present that or do an initial analysis of that for the whole group. And when it comes to data gathering, they could be the ones to reach out to ICANN's GDD or external parties to get the initial data. So from our perspective, we feel that there's a minimum that the subteams can go on to do. And with respect to doing more than that, that is a working group decision, but it would also be based on reporting back regularly to the full group. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you, Mary. George, go ahead, please.
George Krikos for the transcript. Thanks. Yeah, my understanding was that the subgroups were only organizational in nature, not going to be doing any of the policymaking. And I think the main membership group shouldn't be deferring to any recommendations of any subteams. Otherwise, it essentially makes the membership in the subteams mandatory because anybody that wants to do policymaking would have to join them. And it would be basically duplicating the main list that we already have. And I'm not sure that the subteams have all their meetings archived, have all their mailing lists archived. We've seen from past discussions in the last few weeks that, you know, we could have 50 or 60 emails in one day. So if the mailing list was utilized better, I think, you know, we could meet the time requirements that Jeff has been talking about and not just defer to a subteam of five or six individuals. And so that was my main concern. Thanks.
Thanks, George. And that's if we're lucky to get five or six individuals on all of these subteams. But I'm just going to – this is Kathy, of course – and I'm just going to mention something that Jay Scott pointed out in our last meeting, and it may be one of the bases of some of the different interpretations going on here, which is Jay Scott wanted to seed our main working group time slot, the 90-minute time slot, to the subgroups. And now I understand why, because it would allow that larger participation. In the co-chair's call, there was also some concern that it also might delay the discussion, whatever the main discussion is of the working group. But let me just throw that in there, this idea of seeding the slot that we're in to a subgroup for the discussion. Jay Scott, back to you.
Okay. First, that's correct, Kathy. What I'd originally proposed last week, and we talked about briefly, and it was you and Phil did not agree, was that we would every other week the entire group would meet, and on the off week the subgroups would meet. I think we've all got hung up on this two dates, and I want to apologize to the entire group for the confusion between the chairs, because that 2 days, two-meeting limitation was just, this is your first bullet point. You only have two meetings to parse through these questions and come back with a recommendation. Then you were supposed to put together a work plan that would say what your deliverables were, working back from the main plan on when we were going to finish discussions and have the full group recommendation. Okay? Secondly, there is no policy making being done in these subgroups. What they are doing is exploring, taking the time, and bringing to us either recommendations or recommendations out of a full group. The recommendations that would be put in any report will be discussed, and the consensus will be reached in the full group. There is no requirement that you in any way give any sort of deference to to anything that would come from a subgroup. It is merely an opportunity to allow more efficient working. To people who feel they'd be left out, you need to join the working group. To George's point, I haven't seen more than 22 people out of the 400 or so that have either speak up at a call or in any way correspond on the list. So the fact that there's a small subgroup, well, you know what? The reality is there is a small subgroup doing it now. So I think we have to be real here, and anyone who sees a recommendation that should come from a subgroup that they are opposed to can speak up, because it will not be part of the report unless there is consensus at this level, at this working group level. So my idea was to have each of the three work groups meet every other week. They have to have a work plan that is approved by the main group. They have to have a list of questions that has been approved by the main group, and that they would tell us their progress on every other call. We would have 30 minutes allotted to each group where they would present what work they have done. We could have a robust discussion. In the event something was larger, we could have a full 90-minute call on a particular point, and we could also do it. They could present them. We could put in the work plan that they have to present them 2 weeks before they'll be discussed, and they have time for people to discuss online for those that feel like discussing in English may be too uncomfortable for them or not something they want. We can make it work. The two meetings was only to refine the answers and to come back with a plan about how they were going to parse the work and get the work done. And I apologize that I had one understanding of how this would work, and the other two co-chairs seemed to have another understanding of how it would work. But that's how I've done several large working groups before, and I've managed about four. Because what happens is when you have these large calls, you end up getting to the end of the call, and you have six calls on one point. And then nothing gets done, and then the GNO Cell Council gets mad at us, and then everybody says ICANN is completely inefficient because they can't get any work done. So what we have to do, guys, is we have to come up with a way to manage this efficiently. And if somebody has a better idea, I am open to it. But I will tell you, as someone who's managed several of these, and as Mary has said, and as Jeff has said, this is not creating something new. It has been used before. It is an efficient and effective way to get ideas to the forefront so the larger group can discuss, so that we can work our way through this work plan. Because we're already dragging behind. I was not in Copenhagen, but from what I've seen on the list, there was a lot of criticism at our pace. And there are a lot of people who want new GTLDs. At least I'm being told that. I could care less. But there are a lot of people who want new GTLDs. And so it seems to me finding an efficient way to get our work done quicker would answer a need of the larger community that's been reported to me by several people on this call, that that's something everybody wants. Thank you.
Thanks, J. Scott. This is Kathy. Before I move to Jeff Newman, what you're saying is, obviously efficiency and effectiveness are critical. I do think that we're changing what we did in the past. Phil and I were participants in the subgroup, the last subgroup, and there was a sense when we were setting up that subgroup that the working group did not want us to do any substantive work. They did want us to do the organizing and administration. So let me recommend that we continue this for no more than a week, that we kick off the subgroups doing exactly what we've set out in the scope of work here in terms of designing the questions, working with the questions, working with the data, working with the map and the flow and the categorization and the time chart. We can kick all that off, and then for no more than a week, work with the working group to decide how we're going to do this efficiently and effectively. And certainly, we've heard that's my proposal. I'm glad Phil's in the queue, and just see how people feel about passing that off, more substantive work off to the subgroup. Jeff, then Phil, and we have our analysis group, so we'll need to move over to the discussion of the analysis group report. But Jeff, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. So I'm not sure why I'm not sure why we have the need to form subgroups to look at questions. Essentially, that's what we've done for the past couple months now, is look at charter questions as a full group. Look, the way that the subsequent procedures working group works, and it's not the first one to do this type of thing, is that because there are so many people and so many different issues, not very different than this, is that we formed what we call work tracks, essentially a subgroup. Each work track has its own leader or leaders in our case, and those leaders then coordinate the subgroups, as was said before, not to, you know, decide issues of policy, but to work through the issues of policy, to work through the different angles, to work through what different groups may believe, and then essentially to work through potential solutions to bring to the larger group. The larger group is the group that makes the decision. George, if you know, I'm sorry, if you feel like you have to participate in every one of them, then yes, you're going to have additional meetings. But again, people should not feel like they have to participate in every single one, that they have to have their say in every single one. Hopefully, a lot of people here come from groups, whether it's the ALAC, whether it's the IPC or the registries, that they can trust others to convey their group's point of view to the respective work team. If everybody's going to be involved in every policymaking work group and subgroup, A, we'll never get everything done because there'll never be a convenient time for anyone to meet or do the work. B, the burnout is going to be incredible of those people that participate. The burden on the chairs, the three co-chairs in this group is going to be unyielding and unworkable. I just thank, you know, everyone that I have work teams with such great work team chairs for each of the four work tracks that help me out every week, that can take over the full leadership if they ever had to, if I were to get hit by a bus, and I hope I don't. But I think it's worked incredibly well. Nobody has criticized the leadership team or the individual work track teams of deciding policy, and it definitely is more efficient and helps us get to the final final recommendation for the full group much quicker. I'm not a co-chair here, but I strongly recommend that so that the work of this group can feed into the work of the subsequent procedures and be released around the same time. Thanks for phase one. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. Phil, thank you.
Yeah, in the interest of time, what I would propose, the subgroups have to meet at least the next 2 weeks and deal with the organizational issues. During those 2 weeks, I believe the chairs of this group have a call with the chairs of the sub-pro group tomorrow to discuss various issues. We can learn more about their procedure. We can come back to this full working group and present a co-chair's recommendation or give the group some options on how to proceed, how far the subgroup should get into substance and policy recommendations, and let the working group collectively make that decision as to what's going to be most efficient and most fair in final results. So the organizational work has to be done. Let's get the subgroups working on that, and then by the time that's finished in 2-3 weeks, we'll have agreement within this working group on how much further the subgroup should proceed before things loop back to the full working group. Is that reasonable as a way to proceed? I hope so.
That sounds reasonable to me, Phil. And as per Jeff Newman's point in the chat, if people have views, please express them in the chat on the working group. Phil, thank you for...
Oh, and just to add, the co-chairs of this working group are ex officio members of all the subgroups, and I know I plan to be in on all of those calls unless I just have an irreconcilable conflict. So we'll be involved in overseeing all their work, I believe. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Jay Scott. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everybody who commented in this section. Bottom line, please volunteer for a subgroup. And if you know someone who's not on this call, a member who should be volunteering, please reach out to them and ask them to sign up quickly. The subgroup lists have already started, but again, of course, we're accepting new members. Okay, So now we're going to move on to the next part of our agenda, which is talking about and meeting with, it's our follow-up meeting with members of the analysis group. The analysis group, as you'll remember, did an independent review of the Trademark Clearinghouse services, and they published their draft report, and we met with them towards the beginning of our working group meeting. And among the things they looked at, which they had been requested by the GAC to look at, the GAC had asked ICANN to look at least three issues: extending trademark claims, matching criteria, and whether it would make a difference if matching criteria were expanded, as well as sunrise period use. And so the analysis group went out and looked at data, including data that's not accessible to the working group, data within the Trademark Clearinghouse database. And they reported back with a draft report, received comments from the community, and now they've come back with their revised report. And so we are fortunate to have both Greg Rafford, who's the vice president of the analysis group, as well as Stacy Chan, who's a manager, to talk with us about the revised report, about what was changed in the revised report, whether it changes any of the findings or expands any of the findings. And as staff and co-chairs have told the analysis group, their timing is perfect, and we're glad they're back with their revised report. Greg, should I turn this over to you or to
That would be great. And did you happen to get a set of PowerPoint slides from Stacy maybe, an hour and a half ago?
I did not. Mary, did you?
This is Mary from staff. Greg, Stacy, I'm afraid that I didn't receive anything, but if you want to resend them, I can put them up really quickly while you make your introduction.
Yeah, sorry for kind of the confusion around those. I think Stacy will send them to you right now. So as was noted, I'm a vice president at Analysis Group. Stacy Chan, who's also going to be talking some today, was also kind of really deeply involved in the work. And I should just note that the reports were also co-authored with Katja Zeim, who's at the Wharton School. She's an economist by training. And then Jerry Liu at Stanford, who has kind of a long-running expertise, especially in kind of the dispute resolution sphere of the world. And I think you guys provided kind of a nice introduction to the goal of our project, which was to assess the strengths and the weaknesses of the TMCH, all kind of my standard language is that, our goal in this was not to provide specific recommendations, but it really was to provide kind of a fact-based analysis of the TMCH so that groups like this one could work to develop kind of hopefully well-grounded recommendations. And I think we're about to send you the presentation, so hopefully you get it. It's on its way through the Internet. Why don't we go
back? Greg and Stacy, this is Carrie from staff. Sorry for interrupting, but
no,
I did promote you up to presenter if you wanted to try to upload them quickly yourself.
Oh.
I can give you the steps.
Sure.
In the middle screen, select Share My Screen, Share Document.
We need to open the document first. And I think what we'll do in terms of our time today is we just want to give you a brief overview of kind of our findings from the original report. We'll then discuss the kind of the key set of public comments that we received, as well as kind of our responses to those, and in particular the ones that we ended up responding to by incorporating into the revised report. I think at a really high level, the comments that we received and kind of the additional analyses that we performed didn't have any effect on our original findings. So a lot of the original findings I'm going to walk you through are basically unchanged. But I think it's nice to have that context in terms of what the original report did before we dive into the public comments. And it looks like we're slowly, we have to download an add-in. So we're currently downloading an add-in. It will take somewhere between 30 seconds and probably 5 hours. And I guess I see George's question. If we assume everyone has read the report, then one thing that we could just do is jump to kind of the public comments and our responses to those and kind of new analyses that were integrated into the report instead of going through some of the original findings. I don't know if the co-chairs have any guidance they would like to offer in that regard.
Maybe as you're uploading, this is Kathy, you can just provide a quick overview of the report. We've had a number of new people join the working group, so I don't want to spend a lot of time reviewing what we did in our last meeting, but maybe a quick summary would be useful. And then moving on to the public comments and the revisions, and whether you changed your findings or stayed with the original ones. Thank
you. Sure, that sounds great. So, I mean, I think as was mentioned, we focused on three aspects of the TMCH. We looked at Sunrise services, we looked at the claim service, and then we also assessed whether and to what extent the current set of matching criteria that are used by the TMCH should be extended in any way. So with respect to the Sunrise findings, or the Sunrise period, I should say, apologies. I'm just going to my slide, although you guys don't have it yet. We found that approximately 20% of trademark holders who were eligible to use the Sunrise period ever made a Sunrise registration. And then of those that used the Sunrise period, approximately 7% of the registrations were Sunrise registrations. And so, I mean, kind of looking at those findings at a kind of a high level, I would say that there's clearly some interest in the Sunrise period, but it doesn't appear to be a significant interest. We also looked at the claim service, and here, our understanding was that there had been a lot of concern, and this came out in both the interviews that we conducted as well as a survey that we provided to the ICANN community. Here, there was some concern that the use of notifications might be having a deterrent effect on valid registrations. So we assessed this by using data that was provided by IBM, which is kind of one of the vendors for the TMCH. And I think there's a lot of caveats in this analysis, so and we'll get to those in a second. But without those caveats, our analysis suggests that claim service notifications appear to be abandoned approximately 94% of the time, which is high. And I think the issue in interpreting these results, there's two of them. So first, we're not really able to observe the abandonment rate for registrations that don't trigger claim service notifications. So essentially, we don't know what the baseline is. And then the second thing that makes this interpretation a little bit difficult, or the second caveat that I would add, is that it has come to our attention that some registrars, when kind of pinging the IBM data, may not actually be doing so because someone is attempting to make a registration, but it's rather because they might be doing it just for some other reason, and we were provided for several reasons as to why they might be doing so. So we've kind of interpreted the data as every time a registrar pings the TMCH database, it's because someone is attempting to make a registration, but we can't verify whether or not that's actually the case. So our analysis is predicated on that assumption that every attempt is every ping is an attempted registration. But like I said, I can't really caveat that result, I think, too much.
Greg, this is Kathy. May I interrupt
you
for a second? We have the slides up now. Could you tell us what slide you were just on and which one you're moving to?
Sorry. Yeah. Since we have control. Thank you for letting me know we have them up. So
we can return it to your control if you'd like. But right now we all have individual control so that we could catch up with you.
Oh, I see. So I was looking at slide, gosh, it's so small on our screen, sorry. Page six.
Page six. Okay, and so that's the slide you were just talking about, the claim service and the abandonment rate of about 94%.
Yeah, and so if you kind of believe the IBM data and you don't apply the caveats that I did, then the abandonment rate looks pretty high. It's kind of, I think, one conclusion, but I think it's just important to interpret that carefully. In looking at the claim service, we were also interested in understanding to what extent the claim service period should be extended. And here, based on a number of analyses that are in the report, which we can kind of answer questions about in more detail, it doesn't appear that there's really much benefit in expanding the claim service period beyond kind of the current 90 or the relatively standard 90-day period.
Great, and you've got a fairly extensive discussion, this is Kathy again, of why you're making that recommendation in your report and some of the studies that you did.
That's correct. That issue.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a number of figures that I think speak nicely to that. And then now if we go to...
Jay Scott, should we... Excuse me just a second, Greg. Jay Scott, should we take your question now or comment?
Yeah, I just want to make sure I completely understand, because there are people on the call that aren't as familiar with a lot of these issues as some of us. So as I understand, what you're telling me here is that this 94%, you're just assuming a lot of things because you just said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you just assumed that every time they pinged, it was for a registration, but you don't know that because you've learned that they ping the database a lot of times, and registration is not why they ping it.
That's correct. And this will come out when Stacey's talking about some of the public comments we received, and it was something that we had attempted to do in the original report as well. You know, in an ideal world, we would have received data from the registrars that would have allowed us to kind of probe more on this issue. And unfortunately, that just wasn't something that, at least at the time, that the registrars were willing to provide.
Okay, so we're just making an assumption based on interviews from people who had a certain opinion.
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, so I would say that the interviews and the surveys informed our understanding that registrars may not always be pinging the TMCH database because of a registration attempt, and there might be other reasons. Kind of the assumption in the report, although it's heavily caveated, is that every ping we see is because someone attempted to actually register that domain name and maybe did so.
This is Paul McGrady. I'm not on Adobe. Can I get in the queue?
Paul, this is Kathy. Greg, let me ask how you feel about kind of maybe going through one finding, receiving some questions, and then going on to the next finding.
That's
so fine. Let me outline for the group. We're at around slide six, where we're talking about the claim service notifications and the high abandonment rate. And we're going to go on to matching identical matches and other matching issues in just a second. But we're stopping here at this abandonment issue. So that's okay with you, Greg, to take questions now?
Yeah, I went through a PhD economics program, and economists are notorious for interrupting people left and right, so I am very used to it.
Terrific. In that case, let me go on to Jeff Newman, and then Martin Silva-Vallant is also in the queue. Jeff, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks.
This is Paul. Can I get myself in the queue, too?
Oh, I apologize, Paul, of course. I think it's Jeff, Paul, Martin.
Okay, thanks.
Go ahead, Jeff.
This is Jeff Newman. Can you take me through the attempted registrations again, like piece by piece? Because I've operated registries and very familiar with the specs. I want to make sure exactly what you use to determine an attempted registration. So in this case, you got data from the clearinghouse anytime a registrar requested a claims notice to be delivered?
Yeah, so the data that we obtained is from the clearinghouse itself, and it's operated by IBM. And the original, kind of the full database that we received had about 126 million records that indicated, in theory, that claim service notifications had been received. And kind of the structure of the data, you know, for each, we know kind of what the attempted name was. We know the date that it was made on. We know the registrar from which the kind of the attempt was made. Stacey, I don't know if there's anything else that's worth adding.
No, I think just to clarify, we only can see the attempted domain if it was actually registered. If it wasn't registered, then we don't know
how it
was submitted.
So some of these things the registrar may not have actually gone to the registry to request a registration. There may not have been any kind of interaction between the registrar and the registry. They are just registrar queries to the TMCH, which may or may not be properly formed. And do we know that for each of those requests that were sent to the Trademark Clearinghouse, to IBM, that in each and every one of those cases, a claims notice was in fact delivered? So, in other words, do you have the records of the incoming requests and the outgoing notices?
So that's a good question. I don't know if we know for sure whether a notification was sent, but that was our understanding based on discussions with IBM.
I believe we have a time
stamp
for that.
I mean, does that kind of, sort of, or hopefully, ideally, or totally answer your question?
Like, I guess if the number of incoming requests match the number of outgoing timestamps, that would sort of answer it. But again, I mean, I know just anecdotally, I know that registrars after a sunrise period would often send a lot of, quote, requests to a registry to see if there are names available. And if they do it through a check, if they do it through a specific EPP command, which they're not supposed to use, but if they do it through an add or a create command as opposed to a check command, they're going to trigger a clearinghouse, a notice. And some registrars may want to do that to test which names are subject to claims and which are not. And I think if you compared if you looked at a registry in its operation, you will find that there are millions and millions and millions of pings to a registry database that do not nor ever were intended to result in actual registration. And you will probably see that 94% or an even higher abandonment rate or the rate of actual queries that end up being the amount of check commands that end up being actual domains would be a very similar rate. And in none of those cases would I assume that those are attempted registrations. I just don't want us to make the assumption that these are attempted registrations and or that there's a high abandonment rate because we can't tell. We don't have the data to tell.
So those are all really good points, and are kind of consistent with discussions we had in the interviews as well as some of the responses from the survey. One of the things that we attempted to do in the report is to begin to remove what we've kind of referred to as some of these bulk downloads. So if we see that a registrar pings the TMCH for, I'll just make up a number, 100 different kind of domain names at the same point in time. And in particular, there were two registrars that appeared to engage in that type of behavior quite frequently. And so we actually removed kind of those bulk download pings from our analysis. And it actually didn't change our kind of abandonment rate statistic vary significantly, which, you know, I guess potentially lends a little bit of credence to the fact that there could be a high abandonment rate, but we obviously haven't been able to kind of broadly and in every case remove instances of kind of registrars, you know, pinging the TMCH for reasons other than there being an actual attempt.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Greg. This is Kathy. And I'm really glad we have a 90-minute call because we still have half an hour for this excellent discussion. Greg, let me just clarify that since the draft report and the revised report, you've removed some of these bulk pings. That's been a change since in the last report?
It was actually in that sensitivity was also made in the draft report as well. So it's reflected in both.
Okay, great. Thank you. Over to Paul McGrady, who's coming in on the phone line. Paul, please.
Paul McGrady for the record. Thanks, Kathy. Greg, you said something that caught my attention. You said that something along the lines of when you were interviewing the registrars, they were unwilling to share information about why a particular effort to a registered domain name was abandoned. Do you believe they have that data and are simply not sharing it, or is it that it was never collected? I've never come across a platform where a claims notice was issued that then went on to ask, if they did not proceed, went on to ask why they're not proceeding. Do you think that data is out there, or do you think that this abandonment rate essentially has to be looked at in the vacuum because it may be 94%, but we don't really know and have no way of knowing why it's 94%. Rather, they were 94% of the people felt like they couldn't proceed for every reason, or if it's 94% just thought, well, look at that trademark, I ought not proceed. Does that data exist? And if it does exist with the registrars, how do we help you get it? Thanks.
So that is a good question. So I don't know whether or not it exists within specific registrars. If I had to guess, I would say that most registrars probably don't maintain information that would allow you to kind of even get close to backing into what the abandonment rate might be. Perhaps there are some sophisticated ones that do. Some of the larger ones, perhaps, that just, you know, have more domain name registrations and have a sophisticated data collection effort. My guess is that to actually get it the abandonment rate, you would actually need to think about sponsoring some type of third-party survey and partnering with registrars to collect information or to kind of pose a short survey to individuals as they were registering domain names. That's probably how I would go about doing it, but obviously that's, you know, somewhat costly and time-consuming.
So that's proactive in the future, but for purposes of looking at your report and our understanding it, we are essentially, would you agree that we're data impoverished? We don't know if 94% means that everybody was chilled or 94% means everybody was a cyber squatter. We just don't know what it means.
Yeah, it's the latter. We just don't know.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Greg. I'm going to, unless there's a burning, burning issue, I'm going to close the queue after Michael Graham so that we can allow the analysis group to move on to the rest of their findings and quickly move through the rest of their slides. Martin, go ahead, please. Martin, I think you may still be on mute. Hi, Martin. Is that you? Okay. We're not getting Martin, so let's flip to Phil Corwin. And, Martin, you'll be next in the queue.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Phil here. Yeah, a quick observation. There's a lot we don't know here. What we do know, we have a very high abandonment rate, even if half the registrations that began and received a claims notice were either for technical testing reasons or were for gaming reasons to try to reverse engineer and find out if a particular Mark was in the clearinghouse. Let's say half of them were for that purpose. The abandonment rate for the other half would be 88%. If 75% of the initial registration attempts were for technical or gaming purposes, the abandonment rate would still be 76% for the remaining 25% of attempted registrations that were intended to go through to completion. So I think all we can say here is that there's a very substantial deterrent effect on the receipt of the claims notice by people who intended to go through to final completion of registration, and we have no idea to what extent that's deterring bad actors who intended to cyber squat or people who had no infringing intent, because we don't have any data on what the abandoned domains were, much less what use would have been made of them. So I think other than seeing that there's a very high deterrent effect from receipt of a claims notice, there's not much more we can, you know, conclude from this data, would be my view. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Phil. Greg, would you like to respond?
Yeah, no, I think I generally agree. And the only thing I would add to that is I'd kind of like to know what the quote-unquote abandonment rate would look like in a but-for world where notifications weren't sent. I'll make up a kind of a silly hypothetical, but if it were the case that even, you know, if you were in a world where notifications were not sent and 75% of people kind of started the process of registering a domain name and then started to, for whatever reason, opted to then not officially register that domain name, and then you looked at a world where you received claim notifications and you also saw that 75% of people ultimately abandoned the registration, then it wouldn't look like there was too much of a deterrent effect. Now, I think that's probably a silly hypothetical, and I don't really believe it, but I think that's just something to kind of consider in this discussion.
Great. Thank you, Greg. Michael Graham, please go ahead.
Thanks. Greg Michael Graham here. Thanks a lot. I went through the analysis, and maybe this is something you're going to come back to, but I sort of piqued my attention, so I did want to ask about it. On the question, not of the effect of these notices, but on the possible extension of the claims period, I think you said it doesn't appear from the data that there would be much benefit from extending the period because a predominance of notices are filed within those first 3 months, correct?
That's correct.
Right, and I looked at your figure one on page 22, and I do understand that there is a drop-off, which certainly is reasonable because everybody is trying to get in their applications up front if possible. But I came up with a count of up to the first 3 months, 115 was the number of applications, and then after that period for the next 9 months, 102. So there really isn't that great a difference. There is really not that great a fall off over time, but, you know, month to month, yes, there is a fall off. But I'm wondering if, you know, that same information might not just be, you know, read the other way as a rationale for, yes, this does continue to occur, so it would be useful to have this continuing.
Greg, this is Kathy. Before you respond, since we've somewhat shifted issues, and I hate to ask because I know you've got the answer formulated in your head, could you help people who may not have understood the question that was just asked?
I think one of the items that we were interested in exploring is the extent to which the claim service period, which currently runs for 90 days, should be extended so as to allow for essentially for the kind of the notifications to potential registrants to be basically to be sent for a longer period of time. And that might help to deter things like cyber squatting, for example. So one of the things we did is we looked at when specific, basically exact match registrations were made by individuals who were not the trademark holder, so they were some other entity. And we wanted to see, you know, were most of those registrations made during the claim service period, were most of them made after the claim service period, and did we observe any kind of trends over kind of those months, both during and after the claim service period. And what was just kind of mentioned and alluded to is you kind of see, you know, there are certainly fewer exact match registration attempts made by non-trademark holders. There are fewer of those after the end of the claim service period on kind of a month-to-month basis. And there are more of those on a month-to-month basis during the claim service period. But if you were to look, let's say, if you were kind of to sum over all of the months or some of the months after the claim service period ended, those registration attempts, you could actually get to, you know, a relatively large number. And so I think what was being said is, you know, could you kind of spin it the other way and said, look, there's still, you know, in aggregate over those 6 months after the claim service period, you still see a large number of kind of exact match registration attempts being made by someone other than the trademark holder. Kathy, does that help, do you think?
I think that does. Michael, does that answer the question that you asked? Thank you for the background, Greg.
Yeah, well, it actually explains the question that I asked. But I guess the other thing that, while you were explaining that, Greg, I sort of wondered, was there also an analysis of the relationship between the number of exact matches and the number of applications filed during that period, which would show a trend of either decreasing number, decreasing or increasing percentage of applications that were containing the exact matches? I wonder if that was part of your analysis as well.
No, we didn't do that, and I guess I need to give it a little bit of thought, probably offline, to think about whether it would be doable, but we can certainly kind of loop back with the co-chairs on that specific question. You know, I think one of the other analyses that we undertook in the report on this point in particular was looking at whether we saw kind of any change in the disputes using either the UDRP or URS systems for exact matches that were made either during or after the claim service period. And there, we actually didn't, there's actually a kind of incredibly low dispute rate for exact matches made by non-trademark holders after the claims period, which gives us at least a little bit of comfort in kind of suggesting or at least implying that you might not need to expand the claim service period.
Great. Thank you, Greg.
Kathy, this is Brian. I'm sorry, I'm only on the phone. I just
We do have to move on.
Yeah, I got it, but I just want to record for the record. I think I think, frankly, the question hasn't been answered, and it's a question that we raised with the when Greg presented the findings of the draft report to the GAC in Hyderabad, and I think it's difficult to make a normative assessment that there's no benefit in extending the claims notices, particularly for the reason that Michael has raised, and just wanted to mention anecdotally, we, in doing some research for the new GTLD RPMs during the IRT days, we looked at UERP case data, and we found that the vast majority, I don't know the figure off the top of my head, I want to say 60-70%, were exact matches to the trademark. So again, I think it's not to quibble with it, but just to say I think it's maybe slightly dangerous to say that there's, based on the data that's presented in that figure, that there's no benefit in extending the claims notices.
Michael, this is Kathy. As I read it, and obviously we have the authors here, it's not that they said there was no benefit, but that the costs might outweigh the benefits of the extension, and that they had heard about costs from registries, registrars, registrants. But obviously I'll let Greg speak for the analysis group.
No, I mean, I think that's a good point. It's one of the – it's difficult to – you know, I think in an ideal world what you would want to do is perform kind of a top-to-bottom benefit cost analysis of extending the claims period. And it's unfortunately just really difficult to collect, especially all of the costs, and to enter that, for that matter, the benefit information, and kind of put it into monetary terms that would allow you to kind of make a definitive conclusion. So I think our approach was to kind of look at and provide some facts around the issue, but it certainly wasn't to kind of provide an official recommendation on whether the benefits outweighed the costs or vice versa.
Great. Thank you, Greg. I think Martin's microphone is working now. Martin, go ahead, please.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Absolutely.
Hello?
Absolutely.
Oh, great. Sorry that I don't know why the double connect wasn't working right, so I just restart everything. Okay, my question is, I'm not concerned, but I'm curious about if you have done any differentiation on the stakeholders of the abandoned registration. I'm trying to see if there is a problem with the asymmetry between different stakeholders. For instance, are those abandonments particularly from non-commercial stakeholders, or are also commercial? This is to see if there's an specific source or NGOs that have much less power to
Greg, did you get enough of that question?
Yes, that's another good question. Unfortunately, as has been the case at least in some portions of Ryan's report, the data to answer it just wasn't readily available or easily available, or it may not even be available at all. In that, at least for this kind of relies on the IBM data that we've been talking about a little bit, and kind of that level of detail on who actually attended the registration just doesn't exist.
We're getting some feedback from someone. Could you mute microphones, please? Great. Martin's going to be typing some more in the chat room. Greg, are you still on, or did you get cut off?
No, I'm still here.
Okay, terrific. Well, that closes the queue, and thank you for taking questions in the middle of your presentation. We'll go back to the slide presentation. Everyone has their own control, so if you could let us know what slide you're on, we'll just advance it ourselves.
And Kathy, I guess I have a question for you since I think we have about 11 minutes remaining. We could certainly kind of quickly go through the last finding, which is on the matching criteria. Mm-hmm. But I know that there was at least, there's a fair amount of interest in kind of discussing some of the public comments that we received and what, if anything, we did to address those. So I think you need
to do both, because matching criteria is flat in front of this group right now.
Okay.
So
no,
I think you're
that's
finding
context.
Okay.
So I guess I'll try and go relatively quickly through matching criteria to at least leave us some time for the kind of the revised report findings.
Great. And again, just let us know what slide you're on. Thank you.
Yeah, so we're on slide 7, which should be the slide after the claim service slide. So it should say key findings matching criteria. And once again, there's a large amount of additional detail in the report. But so here what we wanted to do is we were curious as to kind of whether there were any non-exact match criteria that might be beneficial to incorporate into the TMCH services beyond what currently exists. And so to do so, what we did is we analyzed the prevalence of several common non-exact text variations that have been used to study typo-squatting domains. And in particular, we examined how often the following were registered. And so these were missing dot typos, fat finger typos, character duplication, character swaps, character removal, plurals, digit addition, and we also added cheap, buy, and I think shop as kind of strings both before and after the exact match trademark string. And, what we found is that non-exact matches were, and I think are, a relatively small percentage of observed registrations, at least the ones that we assessed. And then of those, kind of plural typo and then the character removal typo registrations are the ones that you see most frequently from third-party registrants. So I'll just pause there to see if there's any questions.
Hi, this is Paul. Can I be put back in the queue when we get a minute?
Go ahead, Paul. This is Kathy.
So it's kind of about this topic since, as enforcement goes, we encounter typos quite a bit. but I'm still trying to get my arms around the idea about the cost benefit of extending claims when we do encounter these kinds of typos after claims notices have expired. Did you guys survey UDRP filers about what the cost of filing UDRP are when you came to the conclusion that not extending the claims may not, you know, extending the claims may outweigh the benefits? Did you guys do the calculation on the other side? Because it's not a typical cost benefit analysis, because the registrars aren't paying the cost of UDRP claims, nor are UDRP filers paying the cost of registrars extending a claim service, right? So
that's correct.
You know, when we look at a economic or a market environment that's replete with these sort of non-exact matches, how did you guys come to that math?
So I think we didn't have a chance to, or we didn't incorporate or include that as an interview question as part of our, or a survey question as part of our kind of qualitative research. And I guess I would just say that, you know, I don't think we're saying that the costs of extending the claim service period outweigh the benefits. We are really just looking at kind of, based on kind of the third-party data available, what are trends that you're seeing in the data and what are some conclusions you might draw from it, but not making the final jump to saying you definitely shouldn't extend the claim service period or you definitely should.
Okay, that's helpful. I just wanted to be sure that you guys hadn't, you know, gone through the effort of surveying UDRP filers to understand what their real costs are. Thanks.
That's great. Yeah, thanks.
Great. Greg, thank you. You're doing a great job plowing through a lot of material and answering our questions. What would you like to cover next? What slide would you like to jump to?
I think now we're going to jump to slide 9, I believe. Okay. Double check. And now I think Stacey.
And this is the one titled Public Comment Suggestions?
Yeah, Claim Service.
Great, thanks.
And we'll just be marching sequentially through these. And now I think actually Stacey is going to take over for a little bit.
Great. Thank you, Stacey, and good luck covering tons of material.
Thanks. So before I start going through this slide, since we're starting to run a little bit short on time, I'd offer to just jump to whichever sections people might find of most interest. I know, Kathy, you mentioned that you guys are focusing on certain areas of the TMCH, and we have separate slides for the comments that we received on the claim service analyses, the matching criteria analyses, and the sunrise period analyses, and then additional comments on the report in general. And so if there's an area of particular interest where you think we might want to spend more time, I can start with those and then loop back to other areas if there's more time.
And it kind of sounds like it's probably claim service and matching criteria.
It might be. We've got somebody in the queue. How would you feel about letting people review the slides and answering more questions? You know, kind of going back and forth between questions and covering material for the next 5 minutes.
I think that sounds fine.
Okay, George, go ahead.
George Kirikos for the transcript. I had a few questions, actually, which I posted earlier in the chat. On page 7 of the report, you said that there's the median verified trademarks was equal to 1, so most companies submitted just 1 trademark. I was wondering if you had more data on that in buckets. My second question is, when I mean buckets, say from 2 to 5 trademarks, 6 to 10, more than 10, more than 50, et cetera.
So we do actually. It's not in the report. I don't think it made it into the report, but it was actually something that we put together.
Yeah, so if you could send that to the group, that would be nice. My second question was, on page 9, you listed the top 10 most common strings, like smart, hotel, luxury, et cetera. Can we get a list of, like, maybe the top 500 or the top 1,000 strings to see if, you know, if people are looking for strings like Verizon or Google or Apple, or if they're all looking for, you know, common dictionary words that are, you know, are defensible in terms of fair use, et cetera. Is that data available?
Yeah, it is. I think we can provide it to you. I would have to, I guess, just check with ICANN, ICANN staff, but I think we can provide that data.
And my last question had to do with costs.
the survey results said that, you know, the registries and trademark holders were complaining about costs, and I can't actually have the right to audit Deloitte about costs. My own back-of-the-envelope calculation suggests that the cost could probably be driven down to more like $10 to $15 a year, down from like $90 or $120. Now, if such an audit was conducted, would your group be qualified to do such an economic analysis?
So it's something that we certainly have done in the past for other organizations. I guess I need to give it a little bit of thought as to whether it would be something that we'd be kind of best positioned to do. But I, you know, my first reaction is probably yes, which isn't very definitive. But I think it's.
Great. You've got a thank you from George in the chat room. Greg Stacey, if you want to briefly make another point or two, and then Jeff Newman is in the questionnaire.
I think, you know, just to the point that was just raised about to what extent the cost could be driven down for the TMCH, you know, one comment that we received somewhat frequently, especially from registries and registrars, was this idea that it would be great to have competition for the services that Deloitte and IBM provide together. And, you know, kind of putting on my economist hat, I mean, this kind of, to some extent, feels like a natural monopoly, you know, almost like an electric utility where you have really high cost of setting it up and then pretty low cost of running it. And so given that, kind of having one entity that's kind of regulated, I'll use that term loosely, is kind of, I think, the approach that I would think about, as opposed to being as kind of concerned or interested in kind of bringing about more competition.
But Greg, let me ask: was this in the scope of your review? Is this in the scope of the revised report?
It was something that was certainly brought up in the public comments that we responded to by kind of adding a little bit of a theoretical discussion.
Okay, so this is now part of the new report. Can you, if you could point us now or later to kind of where to find that discussion, I'd love it. I think people would want to read that. And over to Jeff Newman, if that's okay, for a last question.
Yeah, thanks. I wasn't going to raise another question, but I was a little confused by George's comment. When we talk about costs versus benefits, in your mind, in the analysis group, are you just talking about the costs and benefits, the cost of Deloitte or an IBM, or are we talking about costs of registries and registrars and registrants as well? So I'm a little concerned with George's request, because it seems to only indicate that the costs are only those costs by Deloitte. And so, okay, so George is clarifying on it, that's just the $5,000 per registrar. Okay, if that's what we're talking about as the cost, then I guess it's Deloitte and IBM. But if we're talking about costs in general in the industry, we need to be much more expansive of that Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. We are at time, and this has been a long meeting, a 90-minute meeting. Greg, Stacey, I'll hand it over to you for a very quick wrap-up, like 30 seconds, and then we'll figure out when the next meeting is and adjourn the call. Greg, Stacey?
So I guess I don't have too much else to add, but I think we had a really nice, thoughtful discussion with everyone on the group today, and we certainly would be happy to make ourselves available on future calls as you guys are continuing to work through these issues and thinking about them more.
Terrific. That is an offer we may take up. Would it be okay if people have specific questions, we're going to comb the chat to forward them on to you, questions that haven't been addressed yet? Thank you very much. Mary, Terry, can I ask you if you can tell us when the next meeting is? And let me issue the working group's great thanks to the analysis group for joining us not once but twice and spending so much time in discussion with us. Thank you so much. Mary, Terry? When is our next call, please?
Hi, Kathy. It's Terry, and I put it in the chat as well. We have our next call scheduled for next Wednesday, the 12th of April at 1600 UTC. Just confirming for 90 minutes.
Terrific. Terry, thank you for letting us know orally as well as putting it in the chat room. Thanks to everyone for an excellent meeting. Much appreciated. A lot of material covered. I'm certainly going to go back and read through the chat room and look at the slides more closely. Mary will be sharing the slides with everyone. Again, thanks to the analysis group and to everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Operator, if you could please stop recording. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.